Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI honours the figure and the importance of Pope Paul VI. Reactions to the Vatican's new apostolic constitution for Anglicans wishing to come into communion with Rome. Germany and the world celebrate the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And today we celebrate the dedication of the Basilica of St. John Lateran. Jill Bevilacqua tells us all about it. Pope Benedict XVI honoured the figure and the importance of Pope Paul VI on Sunday during a one-day apostolic visit to the northern Italian town of Brescia. He said that Paul VI was a great lover of the Church and that he dedicated all his energies to serving it so that in the Church contemporary man may find Christ. Lydia O'Kane has this report.
Four giant screens relayed Pope Benedict's words to the tens of thousands who filled the rain-swept square before the cathedral, named in honour of the Brescian man who steered the church through the Second Vatican Council and its aftermath.
Carissimi, che dono inestimabile per la Chiesa. La lezione del servo di Dio Paolo VI.
Pope Benedict told them that the encounter and dialogue between the Church and humanity was particularly important to Paul VI in every stage of his life, from the early years of priesthood to his pontificate.
Come non vedere.
In his homily, Pope Benedict XVI dwelt on Paul VI's encyclical Ecclesiam Suum. The major challenges that face the Church, he said, are those represented by its confrontation with other faiths and the growing secularism. The Pope said that the question of the Church, its role in the plan for our salvation, and its relationship with the world today remain absolutely central. Pope Benedict XVI's last words from Brescia, in fact, were for the priests of the diocese. Marking this year for priests, he recalled the words of Pope Paul VI to the major seminary on December 7, 1968. Many, he said, expect the Pope to make dramatic gestures and be energetically decisive. The Pope does not believe that he must follow another line that is not that of confidence in Jesus Christ. It is not about waiting inertly, but of watchful waiting in prayer. This is the condition that Jesus has chosen for us, so that he can operate fully. Even the Pope needs to be helped by prayer. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Thanks there to Lydia O'Kane for that report. Anglican-Catholic dialogue continues to be a priority for both churches in the wake of the publication on Monday of an apostolic constitution entitled Anglicanorum Certibus. The new apostolic constitution published by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith sets out details of a special canonical structure for groups of Anglicans who wish to come into full communion with Rome. An accompanying press statement describes the setting up of a special personal ordinariate as a generous response to the legitimate aspirations of groups of Anglican faithful and clergy in different parts of the world. It allows such groups to maintain their spiritual, liturgical and pastoral traditions, as well as allowing married Anglican clergy to seek ordination as Catholic priests. While the establishment of such structures in the different countries will be done in consultation with the local bishops' conference, ecumenical specialists from both the Vatican and the Church of England stress that dialogue between the two churches remains as an urgent priority, as Philippa Hitchin reports.
Following the publication by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith of the new Apostolic Constitution, Anglican Bishop Christopher Hill, chairman of the Church of England's Council for Christian Unity, said the Vatican's response to requests from individuals and groups across the world does not deflect from the continuing mission of the Anglican Communion, nor from its long-standing commitment to full Christian unity. A view echoing that of the Vatican's own Council for Christian Unity, which insists it's business as usual in the dialogue that has been going on for the past 40 years and has resulted in significant progress under the auspices of ARCIC, the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission. Monsignor Mark Langham is the Anglican expert at that pontifical council.
The Catholic Church has always said that we have as our aim the full and visible unity of Christ's Church. And we must always remember that is our goal, and that never ceases to be our goal. It may be that there are difficulties and that the goal has moved a bit further away, but we are committed to dialogue in search of unity, and also we are committed to pray for and support the Anglican Communion, because a strong Anglican Communion is a vital witness to the gospel in the world, and that's what we want to see alongside the Roman Catholic Church.
During the last week of November, the Council for Christian Unity will be hosting a meeting preparing the way for the next round of ARCIC talks between Anglicans and Catholics, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, is due to meet with Pope Benedict when he comes to attend an ecumenical conference at the Gregorian University next week. Monsignor Langham told us there's been a mixed response to the Vatican initiative from different parts of the Anglican Communion.
The Anglican Church has been very generous, and the archbishops and the statements of other bishops and organisations have been very generous, because obviously this is a sensitive occasion for them. There are groups within the Church of England who have issued statements welcoming the Apostolic Constitution, particularly groups on the Catholic wing of the Anglican Church. Others find it more difficult, but overall it's been a very generous reaction from members of the Anglican Communion.
Monsignor Mark Langham is an official of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of Christian Unity. I'm Philippa Hitchin.
Thanks there to Philippa Hitchin for that report. Germany and the world are celebrating the 20th anniversary of the day the Berlin Wall fell, sending East Germans flooding to the West and setting in motion events that soon led to the country's reunification. Yes, I certainly remember watching on television, and maybe you do too, the night of November the 9th, 1989, when East Germany's fortified border crumbled after 28 years. A momentous and historical moment in the collapse of communism in Europe. Social and political pressure had been building steadily throughout the so-called Eastern Bloc, and on that fatidic evening, during a news conference, a senior Eastern German official, Gunter Schabowski, had offhandedly announced that East Germany was lifting travel restrictions across its border into the West.
Deshalb haben wir uns dazu entschlossen, heute eine Regelung zu treffen, die es jedem Bürger der DDR möglich macht.
Schabowski then said that he didn't know that the change wasn't supposed to be announced until the following morning, and that visas should have been asked for. But his remarks triggered a true and proper exodus of East Berliners, streaming towards the famous Checkpoint Charlie and other border crossings. Facing the river of people and lacking instructions, border guards opened the gates, and the wall, which snaked around West Berlin for 155 kilometres, was on its way into history. By November the 12th, more than 3 million of East Germany's 16.6 million people had at last set foot into the West. Someone else who remembers that night well is Birgit Pottler of the German programme here at Vatican Radio. She was very young back in 89, but agreed to share her memories and her thoughts with me.
I was growing up near the inner German borderline in the western part of Germany.
In the western part. In Bavaria, you said?
In Bavaria, yes.
Right.
And all our guests, all the guests of family, we've brought to the borderline. It was a sightseeing
So you actually used to go and have a look?
Yes.
There was a wall there, even as far down as Bavaria?
No, it wasn't like any border crossing.
Right.
It was a green border. Fields right. and tower. As a child, you've seen nothing, but you've seen the tower, the soldiers with arms. Then as a child, you didn't...
Realize.
You didn't realize why they are there. You didn't see a risk, but you've seen the soldiers and the arms.
But it was part of your everyday landscape.
Yes.
And although there was no wall to remind her that there was another, different reality on the other side of the border, Birgit says she was very aware of it, both because her family was very politicized and spoke about it, and also because she went to church.
We are aware because, for example, although my diocese was divided, and so not only at home, also if you went to church, if you went to parish meetings, mm-hmm. youth meetings,
right.
we talked of this. And once a year you send a parcel with bananas.
Really?
Bananas?
Yes. What did you send?
Toys, but books weren't allowed. And it was difficult.
But did all the families of the parish send a parcel once a year?
A lot of that.
And what about that famous November night in 1989?
In 1989, I was in my family,
right.
And I remember I was crying all the night in front of the TV, and it was clear that there's changing. It's changing not only Berlin, not only Germany, it is changing the world. I think that also as a child, I was able to recognize this revolution.
Why were you crying all night?
It was an emotion. It mm-hmm. was an emotion. Mm-hmm. And I think if you see now, it yep. was very moving.
Yes, still today, the images, the television and film footage showing hundreds of thousands of elated and incredulous people taking their first steps into freedom is very moving indeed.
You were talking about how moving the images are. You're right. I've been looking at the images as well, and it really struck me to see how many people just got up and left, even seemingly without taking their belongings,
yes.
without their suitcases.
Yes, and it was a risk that they haven't got the possibility to return.
These past few months, I know that you have been doing a lot of interviews
yes.
in the lead up to this historic anniversary. What have you learned from the people you've been speaking to? Who have you been speaking to in these past few weeks?
I'm speaking to the representatives of the church, because we must remember that this revolution has parted in the churches.
When Birgit says parted, she really means was born from.
Because the church has been a free room in the DDR. In the churches, people have the possibility to say what they think, to discuss. And in autumn 89, I would say that the people had to go
out,
had to go in the street.
So that free room, as Birgit calls it, a space provided by the churches in which people could really talk out and express their feelings and their opinions, wasn't large enough anymore. But it is fundamental, she says, that the important role played by the church is not forgotten in these days of celebration.
The celebration days this year has to remember also that this revolution has parted...
From the churches.
And the people I've spoken to remember always it was a miracle. It was a miracle. It's the word most important of this year. It's a miracle. Because it was a revolution, a peaceful revolution.
And a miracle, of course, brings with it high hopes and expectations. And not wanting to put a damper on things,
Birgit told me that today, 20 years later, Germany still has much work to do to bring about a true and equitable reunification, ironing out the many, many problems that became clear right from the beginning, at the dawn of the new era.
After have broken down the wall, you had to unify the nation. And until today, it isn't reunified at all. There are problems, economic problems. People in Western Germany, in ex-Western Germany, had to pay tax for the reconstruction of the eastern part of Germany that made them angry. Before 89, before 89, there were the subsidies for the business along the inner German borderline. After 89, there were no more subsidies. A lot of economies collapsed. A lot of people lose the working place.
Right.
Unemployment increased. And now, today, the unemployment is very high in the eastern part of Germany. Young people must go in the west. In the eastern part of Germany, there's a lack of medicines, of doctors. There's a lack of doctors. There's a lack of...
So it's another Germany.
It's another Germany, yes.
Would I notice going to Germany as a tourist that there are two different realities?
No. If you go as a tourist, that's another point who has made angry the people in the western Germany. The eastern part of Germany now is a more beautiful part.
Because of the reconstruction.
Because of the reconstruction. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful... It's very, very beautiful. There's a lot of culture. It was very important, this reconstruction.
She told me that the government is busy trying to set up a system that will guarantee health and education services, especially for the poor, many of whom today can't help but think back with a touch of nostalgia.
It's very important to remember this year, to remember the reality before the break of the wall. To remember that there were a lot of problems in the DDR. There was injustice, that the people had no freedom. But it's also important to say now, not all the things are better. It's very important to remember and to say, no, we have freedom, but we have also a responsibility to grow up, to reunify always more.
Most Catholics think of St. Peter's as the Pope's main church, but they're wrong. St. John Lateran is the Pope's church. It's the cathedral of the Diocese of Rome, where the Bishop of Rome resides. And today, November the 9th, is the day the church celebrates the dedication of this basilica. In a sense, St. John Lateran is the parish church of all Catholics because it's the Pope's cathedral. But stay tuned as Jill Bevilacqua tells us all about it in this programme with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
The Pope's Cathedral, defined by Clement XII as mother and head of all the churches of the city and the world, was originally built by Constantine over the barracks of the Equites Singulares, the emperor's private guards, in 324. The Lateran Palace previously belonged to a rich patrician family, the Laterani, but in AD 67 Nero trumped up a charge of conspiracy against the head of the family and had him executed, so he could confiscate his estate. The palace became an imperial residence, and Constantine chose it as his own after his victory over Maxentius at the Milvian Bridge, but a year later presented it to the Pope in gratitude for his success. The first basilica was dedicated to the Redeemer, but vandals and earthquake took their toll, and at the beginning of the 10th century it was completely rebuilt by Pope Sergius III and dedicated to John the Baptist and John the Evangelist. Henceforth it was known as St. John on the Lateran. In his Paradiso, Dante wrote how
the barbarians from the north stood in mute wonder mid the works of Rome, when to their view the Lateran arose in greatness more than earthly.
Though the building Dante and the barbarians saw is not the one we see today, the feeling it inspired was clearly one of awe, and that this is what the beholder was supposed to feel is reflected in the opening words of the introit of the old Mass of the feast.
Terrible is this place, It is the house of God and the gate of heaven, and shall be called the court of God.
But this terrible place was almost totally destroyed by a fire in 1308, caused apparently by the negligence of some plumbers who were repairing the roof. Restored again, it was again burnt down and again restored. By the time Borromini was called in by Innocent X in the mid-17th century, there was precious little left of the original structure. In 1855, Leo XIII had the apse rebuilt. But although it was his favourite church, Pope Leo was unable to visit or officiate in his cathedral. As the London Daily Telegraph reported on August 21, 1899.
The Holy Father, confined within the precincts of his palace, a prisoner for 21 years, has never quitted the Vatican, has never felt free to visit the church, which, as Bishop of Rome, is peculiarly his own, the Lateran Basilica of Constantine.
Although on his death in 1903, Pope Leo was buried in St. Peter's, in 1924 his remains were transferred to the Lateran. And 5 years later, with the signing of the Lateran Pacts, the popes returned, and since then each has taken solemn possession of the basilica in his role of Bishop of Rome. The vicissitudes of the Lateran Basilica might seem far removed from the words spoken by our Lord to the Samaritan woman at Jacob's well, but the gospel for the feast of the church's dedication is surely not a casual choice, wrote St. Paul to the Corinthians.
You are God's building. Didn't you realize that you were God's temple and that the Spirit of God was living among you? The temple of God is sacred, and you are that temple.
And to the Athenians he declared,
the God who made the world and everything in it does not make his home in shrines made by human hands.
And although we need our churches, our covered buildings in which to worship God in an assembly, there is no single place, temple, mountain, or basilica, which alone possesses him. In the new religious spirit brought by Jesus, writes one scholar, God must be recognized and worshipped primarily in the inner consciousness. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth, writes Piero Bargellini.
Worship of the Father had to correspond to the fullness of divine revelation, that is, to the truth and to the purity of its essence, in other words, to the spirit. No geographic location would impoverish that worship, which would appear everywhere among all peoples.
Writes a biblical scholar,
in the language of John the Evangelist, the truth is the divine revelation which Jesus has come to communicate, while the divine spirit is poured out into men's hearts. Perfect worship, therefore, is faith in Jesus, in his word, and in the strength of the spirit which he gives. In this light, he can be identified with the Messiah prophet, whom the Samaritan woman is awaiting, together with her countrymen and Israel itself.
Taib was the name the Samaritans gave to the Messiah, and it meant he who returns or will return. I know that Messiah, that is, Christ, is coming, said the woman to Jesus, and when he comes, he will tell us everything. The woman would hardly have expected this stranger to answer, I am he, as he did. But she sensed something of the sort, and is so dumbfounded that she leaves her water jar and goes hot-foot to the town to tell everyone, exclaiming, I wonder if he's the Christ. The episode at Jacob's well is as deep as the well itself. It takes us some time to get to the bottom of it. And talking of Jacob's well, it's still there, and you can draw water from it. Various churches grew up over the well, but the most recent one, begun in 1914, was never finished. A project of the Pravoslav Church of Tsarist Russia, it was abandoned on the outbreak of the revolution. But let's get back to that historic encounter between an Orthodox Jew and a Samaritan, a woman at that. Wrote David Smith in The Days of His Flesh.
A Jew might not greet a woman, he might not talk with a woman on the street, even if she were his own wife or daughter or sister. In the morning prayer, the men blessed God, who hath not made me a Gentile, a slave, a woman. It was impiety to impart the words of the law to a woman. Sooner should they be burned.
And here was Jesus asking this woman for a drink. And not only was she a woman, but a Samaritan woman. She herself exclaims, how is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria? And the evangelist explains, Jews, in fact, do not associate with Samaritans. But it was a lot worse than that. In the book of Ecclesiasticus, we can read,
there are two nations that my soul detests. The third is not a nation at all. the inhabitants of Mount Seir and the Philistines, and the stupid people living at Shechem.
The stupid people were the Samaritans. But who were the Samaritans, and why were they so hated? And the feeling was reciprocated. When Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem, he sends messengers into a Samaritan village to make preparations for him, we read in Luke. And he goes on, but the people would not receive him because he was making for Jerusalem. And James and John, the sons of thunder, immediately turn to Jesus with a suggestion. Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven to burn them up? What they thought when they found Jesus talking to a Samaritan woman, we don't know. The Samaritans have been called the strangest and most ancient sect in the world. They claim that they are the only true representatives of the ancient children of Israel. They are descendants of a remnant of the original Jewish population of Samaria, and people brought to the region by the Assyrians after the fall of the Kingdom of Israel in 721 BC. Because of this crossbreeding, the Jews consider them impure. And when they began to rebuild the temple after the Babylonian captivity, they refused to allow the Samaritans to take part. In the 4th century BC, the Samaritans seceded from mainstream Judaism and built their own temple on Mount Gerizim, according to the plan of the temple in Jerusalem. From Jacob's well, where Jesus was sitting that day, it was easy enough to look up at the stony heights of the mountain, where, as the woman reminded him, our fathers worshipped. Today there is no temple on the mountain, only a heap of ruins, and the tomb of a holy sheik, but we may read.
South of the sheik's tomb is a flat rock which the Samaritans identify as the Rock of Foundation, from which the act of creation of the world started. The Samaritans consider the rock very holy and have fenced it. Near this stone is the place where the Samaritan community gathers every year to celebrate the feast of Passover and sacrifice the Paschal Lamb, a custom practiced by the Samaritans ever since the days when their temple crowned the mountaintop. In previous generations, they used to camp on the summit of the mountain for the whole week of Passover.
In a book on the ceremonies at the holy places, there's a detailed description of what the writer calls the world's oldest rite, the aim and fulfilment of the Samaritans' existence as a people. And there let us leave them, the whole congregation clothed for the occasion in robes of white linen, facing the rock on the summit of Gerizim, which marks the site of the Holy of Holies of the Samaritan temple, waiting for the solemn moment when the sun drops to the horizon and the high priest turns to face the congregation, and the sacred rite begins. The Samaritans still worship in a synagogue according to their ancient and peculiar laws, we read.
The only books of the Bible which they recognize are the 5 books of Moses, and their most treasured possession is an ancient copy of the Pentateuch written on lambskin by, so they claim, Aaron, the brother of Moses. This extraordinary manuscript is written in the ancient Samaritan characters on the hair side of ancient sheepskin. The manuscript is in the form of a scroll wound on 2 rollers. The parchment is so old and brittle that it crinkles up, and so brown that bits of it are illegible.
Today's Samaritans are still ruled by a high priest, whose predecessor, centuries ago, was a rival to the high priest of the temple in Jerusalem. But there is no temple today, either on Mount Gerizim or in Jerusalem. And our temples today, our churches, are nothing to what our Lord and later St. Paul wrote of authentic worshippers.
The temple of God is sacred, and you are that temple. You are part of a building that has the apostles and prophets for its foundations, and Christ Jesus himself for its main cornerstone. As every structure is aligned on him, all grow into one holy temple in the Lord, and you too, in him, are being built into a house where God lives in the Spirit.
You've been listening to a programme written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett. Laudetur Jesus Christus.